And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. Well, you knew it was coming, and now it's here. This is the week we talk about Man of Steel. The cape, the shoulders, the story, and whatever else we can think of. Then we'll talk about things that got better with age. Our age, their age, we shall see. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books and the occasional movie for the NPR website.
Indeed. Trey Graham is off this week, and we thought that we would bring in a man who needs no introduction. Well, maybe a
probably
little.
Needs some.
Maybe a little introduction. We bring him in for punching.
Yep.
For superheroes.
Fighting robots.
For fighting robots. Ladies and gentlemen, with us in the studio today, Chris Klimek. Hello, Chris Klimek.
Great, Scott. Hello.
What do you do when you're not guesting on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour? What else do you do, Chris?
I write about theater for the Washington City Paper and sometimes about Star Trek for you.
Wonderful. That's right. You did. If you've read Chris's epic essay on Star Trek, you'll remember that. So we all went to see Man of Steel. Now, spoiler alert, some of you may know this already. Glenn wrote a book about Superman.
Duh?
Wait.
What devil you say?
Glenn wrote a book about Superman. So I feel like the only thing I can do is go to everybody else first, and then we'll go to Glenn last.
This book that I wrote, do you mean Superman, the unauthorized biography?
I do. You're
available in fine bookstores everywhere?
You're the unauthor of Superman.
That's the book you're talking about, that
yes,
one?
Yes, it is.
Superman, the unauthorized biography?
Superman, the unauthorized biography.
Good then.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. I'm going to go to everybody else first, and then we'll go to Glenn last, because otherwise nobody else will have anything left to say, because Glenn will have unloaded all the wisdom that there is. Stephen Thompson. I saw you over the weekend, and you indicated to me what your opinion was. You will be unable to say it exactly the way you said it to me
right.
on our podcast, because
right.
we don't use that kind of language. But go ahead and tell us what you thought of Man
Do
of
we
Steel.
Use the word turd on the podcast?
No, I
hated this movie. I uh-huh. hated this movie. Uh-huh. The beginning, the kind of setup, I found mostly boring. Very pretty to look
that
at.
That was the good part.
Right. Yeah. I mean, certainly with its share of inexplicable whatnots, which will I have pages of things I found.
It's like a guy in a cape flying.
Well, right, yeah. What's with the flying? No, the you know kind of standard origin story stuff. Once it devolved, and it's not a spoiler to say that it devolves into an absolutely endless orgy of building smashing.
It's true.
Part of it is that this movie has the disadvantage of following immediately, certainly in my viewing, immediately after Star Trek Into Darkness and Iron Man 3, which were big building smashy
yeah.
movies.
Yeah.
But I just feel like I've seen cities leveled over and over again. It costs a fortune to mm-hmm. simulate it, and yet I just feel like I'm watching animation. Mm-hmm. I'm watching pictures of buildings knocked
yeah.
down.
So you gave it like a B+.
I hated it. I also thought it was just incredibly stupid, but we'll get back to me.
Chris Klimek, feelings?
I loved it!
Feelings on Man of Steel?
I like the mostly boring part best. I mean, this is a problem with the Richard Donner Superman 2, where I know you guys have talked on the show how you feel like it takes too long to get going. There's too much world building. There's too much time on Krypton. There's too much time in Smallville. You know, I prefer that over the building smashing, which
yeah.
I feel like that is, you know, depicted in this film in a way that kind of demands a response, and that is a horrible failing of this movie, that it doesn't really give us any of Superman trying to protect the
trying to protect anyone
the occupants yeah. of these buildings
except Lois Lane
yeah. right
I will say I got to the end of the movie and I turned to Glenn and I said, nice job saving the earth, kind of.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel like it's a little unfair to pile on to this movie when I feel like that's a flaw that's inherent in
right.
so many of these kinds of films, certainly right. in the Avengers,
but the Avengers has certainly. A sense of humor and this one doesn't.
That's true. There are exactly two jokes that I counted in Man of yeah. Steel, and I only thought one of them was funny.
It's true. And I will say, you know, I have to agree that if you have a sense of humor, you can knock down all the cities that you want. But joylessly destroying cities. No,
I really liked it up until we started punching each other through the buildings.
Yeah, it was interesting because a couple weeks ago, NPR's own Ari Shapiro came to me with this very question about other movies, about it was the Star Trek movie,
mm-hmm.
and had sort of made this point that there's a tremendous amount of massive destruction. And this was when I said to him, well, did you see Fast and Furious 6? And then I melted into my chair because he has not seen Fast and Furious 6. But the same thing is true in Fast and Furious 6, that you get a tremendous amount of destruction and presumably death. Not as much as in Man of Steel. But it is a very common way they're doing things now.
Well, and it is, I've heard it pointed out, that in Fast and Furious 6, there's actually Vin Diesel at one point attempts to steer the destruction away from the people in ways that Superman does not. Vin Diesel cares more about the people than Superman. This is where I really want to recommend an article in Vulture by Kyle Buchanan called Is It Possible to Make a Hollywood Blockbuster Without Evoking 9/11?
Yeah.
And it is full of fantastic phrasing, even like a bloodless massacre of concrete, which is exactly what this is. And also, and what this is kind of bringing into our discussion here, quote, action heroes used to prevent disasters. Now they can only avenge them.
Right. I think that's right. And I will actually go farther, I think, than Chris in saying I was pretty much fully on board with this movie for the first 60% of it or so. I actually really liked the first half or so of this movie. I was perfectly okay with a much less fun-oriented idea of Superman. And that sounds, I wouldn't want this to be the only version of Superman.
Right.
I treasure and adore the Donner movies. But as Glenn has said a million times, part of the problem with Superman Returns is that it was trying too hard to evoke...
This is the 2006 reboot.
To evoke the same mood as the Donner movies. So to me, it made a certain amount of sense.
It's actually a sequel, because it continues from the Donner.
Right.
Yeah, this is the reboot, Man of
right.
Steel.
And so I was okay with the fact that it was darker. I am always the one who's like, I'm so sick of this stuff at the beginning with the, and then this happens. And
oh,
then
you didn't want the long stretch of exposition.
But I was okay with it in this movie. For the kind of Russell Crowe part at the beginning, I stayed in it and I felt I was not incredibly aggravated by it. I enjoyed the Kevin Costner business. I enjoyed the parent stuff. And I particularly liked the fact that it was not drawn as a dual identity movie, that it wasn't a kind of...
He's got to keep his secret
that he's over here, he's Superman, but over here, he's Clark Kent. What I particularly like about that is that although certainly there are issues with Lois and the portrayal of that relationship in any Superman movie, because you're always going to be winding up to that iconic shot of him carrying her off, which is never going to look like equality. But the fact that he's not working the dual identity does save her from having to be a dope who doesn't recognize that the guy is the same guy except with glasses, which always makes Lois seem kind of like a stooge.
Right.
And I did appreciate that. I think that the story of, I said to Glenn when we saw it, there is an exchange that leads to Jonathan Kent's, Clark's father, being very determined not to let people find out about him. Where he essentially, instead of saying, I think the traditional way of presenting that is, you know, they won't accept you and they'll dissect you and, you know, they'll make a freak out of you. He was more saying, Costner's character was more saying, various kinds of kooks are going to take advantage of the idea of life from other planets and the idea of your abilities will take advantage of it and twist it and misunderstand it, and it will become a negative thing because of the way people will use it and talk about it. And I thought that was a lot more interesting. I liked the fact that his powers were not primarily presented as get a kitten out of a tree, stop a train from, you know, they were going
and
for
that's
something
that's usually where the
bigger.
Joy comes into
I
these
know.
Movies, though.
I
and
know.
They admitted I that. I mean, and that would have only been maybe a minute and a half or 2 minutes of screen time. I'm not sure why it's not there. I feel like there's room for it in a movie that already runs 2 hours and 23 minutes.
But having said all of this, I was on board for that first 60% or so. That last hour is just murderous. Like, it is just endless. There is a point where I was really super ready for them to be bringing it in for a landing, and I thought they were.
Oh, well, yeah, there are like seven false endings.
There are, and they come. It's a real trap when you put in a false ending at a place when people really are ready for it to end. And for all the times that we've sat here and said, it was too long, this movie was too long, this is one where if you had taken that last hour-long battle. Now, this movie comes in at 2.5 hours, which apparently is what we do now with all our blockbusters, which is a whole separate problem.
Well, and we blow up more and more and more and more stuff.
If you took that hour-long, punishing, pulverizing business at the end, and you made that a 20-minute tight, well-edited action denouement like I'm used to seeing in a movie like this, mm-hmm. which would bring it in more like 2 hours instead mm-hmm. of 2.5. I know exactly where to cut it. That just all has to be shorter. It's too long. It's not interesting. It doesn't go anywhere. It's poorly edited, and I wound up not liking the movie because of this endless back
end. And in a strange way, when you're massacring that many people, all of the blood off screen. Yes, it takes time. But it also makes it feel like there are no stakes.
Right. Right.
Right. There are two big action sequences here. There's two climaxes. There's the one in Smallville, and then there's we move to Metropolis where the buildings start getting knocked over. The Smallville one I thought was really good. I thought the action was clear. I thought we were tracking a lot of ancillary characters, and Superman's telling them, go inside. It's not safe out here. He felt like Superman in that, in that part, and then that all goes away in the larger denouement.
Right. All right, Mr. Weldon.
All right, I'm not actually going to talk very long because I've already written a review for NPR, and Keith Phipps was kind enough to ask me to expand upon that for their site, The Dissolve. But basically, I wanted to see the trailer. Now, that's on me. I shouldn't have watched the trailer. This is how Zack Snyder gets me every single time. He makes great trailers. The trailer captured something essential about this character. Kind of nailed who this character is, what he wants. He wants to save everybody. There's imagery and iconography about the kid putting his hands on his hips with the cape. Mm-hmm. I did think Cavill was excellent for several reasons, but I thought he was perfect in this role.
Yeah.
This idea of you can save them, you can save them all. That's who this character is. What this film got wrong, tragically, egregiously, was the tone. This film is grim, it is dour, and the violence, as you've all said, doesn't escalate as it does in other films. It just repeats and repeats and repeats. And using the 9/11 imagery is something that is being done by this film very, very intentionally, very cynically, to goose our emotional reaction, to trade on that, to make us feel more strongly about this violence we're seeing on screen. That is, what's the word? Evil. I think it's evil. I think it's a terrible thing to do. I also think, as Stephen pointed out, it is completely ineffective because all it does is fill us with a sick dread that takes us right out of the film and reduces the stakes. You're raising a city, you're not raising the stakes, and you just make these characters who are caroming off. This is the other thing that bothered me. The camera doesn't even follow Zod and Superman when they carom off a building. It lingers on these shots of destruction. It is sick. And it's also not interesting. That's probably the greatest.
So maybe a straight B from you.
You know, here's the thing that, you know, fanboys are not so much divided about this, right? Because, you know, Mark Waid is a writer who's written several great Superman stories. He hated this film for reasons that have to do with the final twist, which we can't get into.
Right.
But that didn't bug me as much because there's, well, I can't. Mm-hmm.
No, I know what you're saying. There's very little that there's no precedent for with Superman if you have read all the stories. So when you start to get into a kind of, it's not Superman-y for him to do this or this or this, you have to understand that there are precedents for most things. Is that fair to say?
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of people were talking that the 2006 film Superman Returns was the 9/11 version, like the post-9/11 version of Superman. That never made sense to me because it always was a very romantic kind of harkening back to the Donner film. This is the post-9/11 Superman. They put a stamp on this character. They darkened him. They darkened the world because they felt like they wanted to plug it in to the Nolan Batman films, so that these two characters now share a monochromatic, emotionally gray universe.
Joyless.
Utterly joyless. This is a Superman film. It should not be joyless. We should see him smile more than once.
Well, yeah. But on top of it, in addition to the joylessness, you have these big, hammy... I mean, you have Michael Shannon doing to the scenery what the CGI is doing to the buildings.
Right.
And, you know, you have these, like, release the world engine and I will rebuild Krypton atop his bones! And you have all these...
That's my go-to now.
You have all these big, ridiculous, silly things that should be fun, but it's part of this tone, like you said, tone, Glenn. It's pummeling.
Yeah.
It's just pummeling and pummeling and pummeling.
Yeah.
So it's not really satisfying. Like, there's silly moments and you kind of squirm at it. It's silly. Like, it should be
sure.
fun, and it's not.
Well, and I do want to talk a little bit about Cavill because the cast, Glenn's eyebrows just went doing doing. You should know, the casting of a guy who was British, right?
Wait.
Originally very controversial because if you're true to his actual creative roots, Superman should be half Canadian. So this was very controversial. And this is sort of where I do want to address the fact that I know that Chris feels very strongly Cavill is,
you know, I just feel like there were people who were actually born in Kansas who stand over 6 feet tall who are available, who have the right initials, for instance. I don't know. I mean, how hard did we really look?
Well, here's my question. Do you really think that Cavill is short? Yeah, or is this just something? Is he just short in your mind?
I think he's great in the movie, actually.
Great in the movie, too.
You know, and I know he was on the list before. Apparently, he screen tested for Superman in 2004 or something when
Mick
G was going to make the movie. Yeah, it was also one of the finalists for James Bond when it ended up being Daniel Craig.
He is also tall enough that Amy Adams, intrepid reporter, is running through various dangerous reportorial assignments in like 9-inch spike heels.
There is that too.
Yeah.
Chris has been making a thing about how, you know, he could have tested for the role. A couple things there. You are a dear friend, Chris, but A, I've seen you act, and B, I have seen Henry Cavill. I have ogled Henry Cavill, Senator. You are no Henry Cavill. All due respect.
Yeah, I think you're inadequately triangular.
Oh, man. Well, you know, so one thing that's very, very endearing about the way that Cavill has been promoting this movie is he has been very candid in interviews about how difficult it was to make himself look like this. He says when he did his screen test for this, they gave him a replica of the Christopher Reeve Superman costume to wear that was very unflattering for him, probably because Christopher Reeve is about 4 inches taller than Henry Cavill.
Oh, my gosh. But, here we go.
You know, he said he wasn't in great shape at that time. He talked about how he wouldn't eat on the days when they were going to shoot him with his shirt off and stuff. So he's been
very... What is the vicarious version of short man syndrome? See, I don't think that Cavill is short. I think Cavill makes you feel short.
Psychology.
I think Chris sits there watching Cavill and thinks, I feel short.
And also, let's just go back to the source material here. There's nothing, Superman doesn't have to be tall, because the original Superman, Joe Shuster was a wee little dude, and he drew Superman as kind of a peewee. And also, the other thing that you need for Superman is shoulders. Check. He's got that.
He's got two.
He does.
He's got two
he
of them.
He does have two.
He does.
And,
at least.
And he has a lantern jaw. This is just
true.
Unbelievably square. You, true. Chris, more a decorative sconce. But him, a lantern jaw.
Chris, you're bringing this all on yourself because you've been, you know.
You know what I loved about this
giving
movie?
Giving him a hard time on Twitter.
I love the dad stuff.
Yeah.
I like
this. This is a nice Father's
too.
Day release. Jarrell, and especially Kevin Costner. When was the last time you liked Kevin Costner in a movie this much?
I did like the dad stuff. I liked the dad stuff. I felt like I bought that relationship. I bought the importance of it. They make a little bit of a shift to the end of his relationship with Clark that I think.
So we're not going to spoil that?
I mean, I don't think you need to, except to say they sort of add a little bit of emotional heft to that for me by tying it back to his desire not to be found out and things like that in a way that I think, I feel like I'm the only person who thinks this, but honestly, up until it goes into that ridiculous spin out at the end, it was working for me
as a family story,
and it is grim, but I don't think it had to be grim. It's not a rule of the universe that Superman has to be funny in the same way that Christopher Reeve in the big giant glasses was funny. I would have bought it if they hadn't spent a damn hour knocking over buildings.
Right. Well, I want to try to bat off the charge of grim a little bit. I mean, it's clear that you all see it as being sort of relentless and oppressive in that way. And certainly the Dark Knight is the template that they're working off of. David Goyer wrote the screenplay here with Chris Nolan and all that. But I feel like the Dark Knight makes allowances for the audience to have some catharsis in a way that this movie doesn't. There's a wonderful scene in the Dark Knight that you guys might remember where it's, you know, we're like 2/3 of the way through the movie and the Joker has set up this elaborate prank where there are prisoners on one boat and then like regular civilians on another and one of them has to blow the other up or they're both going to blow up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's this whole tease where this convict, takes the detonator away from this regular guy and says, you don't have the guts to kill someone, I'll do it. And then he throws the detonator out the window. And that got applause in the theater when I saw it. And that has nothing to do with Batman. That's a hooray for us kind of scene. There's a scene in Spider-Man 2, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man 2, where Spider-Man exhausts himself saving this runaway subway car and his mask is torn off.
Right, yeah.
And the people you know, they carry him on their shoulders. It's very Christ-like and everything, but it's not Spider-Man has...
It's decency and humanity.
Right, and that is missing from this movie, and that's a flaw, especially since, you know, we get all the stuff about how Superman is supposed to inspire us to be better.
Well, and supposed to be so drawn to humanity's fundamental decency that he chooses to embrace humanity.
Yeah.
Can we get back to how much this movie sucked?
I really feel very alone in it. I feel like people's reactions at first to this movie were much more mixed. And I feel like it's just become kind of a runaway train of everybody hates it.
I'm not sure. I've seen some spirited defenses of
this movie. On the whole, I like it a lot. I think the climax is very, very problematic. I wish there were a few more jokes. But, you know, I got my moments of chills. I mean, when he takes off. I love all that.
Why didn't he do that sooner? I kept getting pulled.
You know,
it's like one
hour seems to be about the mark. It takes an hour for Batman to get suited up in Batman Begins. Mm-hmm. It takes an hour for Superman to take off in Richard Donner's Superman 1. It takes him about an hour to get to the ice ship and find his costume here.
But in this movie, unlike a lot of the other movies you name, even in the first part of it, I kept getting distracted by gigantic holes in the plot, gigantic things that made no sense. Why would you sentence the traitorous murderers to survive the destruction of the planet?
Okay.
We're
going to put you in the panic room.
You know, the whole, like, oh, we also found a world engine in the space yard sale. And so we have, our exposition, we're going to develop, we have a world engine. There's just a ton of that stuff where you just, I kept rolling my eyes.
But having said that, I will give it credit for one thing, and I pointed this out to Glenn at the time. In many of these movies, you wind up with a situation where at the end you just think of the bad guy, of the main baddie. Why is he doing this? Why is he destroying Earth? What is the problem?
They do give Zod better motivation in this movie. They make him an interesting character,
that's
I think,
what I mean.
Because you kind of understand what he's doing.
They had a theory for he wants to kill us all for this reason.
Right.
Because this is what his plan is. And I thought, okay, that's a plan. I understand how that might be your plan. And it was better for me than Lex Luthor wants to make money on real estate as a big motivator.
But I felt like they massively, unnecessarily complicated it with endless blabber about codexes. Codex is one of those words where I'm just instantly bored.
Yeah.
And there was so much.
That's a you thing, Tom.
But, well, a lot of this is a me thing. But to me, they muddied up the story so much with so much need for exposition and, Russell Crowe yammering and
this didn't feel like a superhero film. There wasn't uplift. There wasn't moments chills. I didn't get them. What I got was Transformers. What I got was Battleship. Yeah. What I got was a certain cheapness of low stakes spectacle for spectacle's sake that didn't connect. I never wanted to cheer. Even when I wanted to cheer, it was because he did something with the world engine on one side of the world that wasn't quite sure what he was doing with it. I was pretty sure it was done. But then there was all this thing happening half a world away where all the people are.
I don't think anybody's defending that sequence.
Right.
The world engine and the pulsing and
I was intrigued that they're leaning so hard into the science fiction aspects of his story because nobody's done that. People concentrate on him on Earth. Yeah. This is a different take. Yeah. It didn't work for me.
Yeah. Well, that's in the way that people point out that the Nolan Batman movies, some people say that they're crime movies more than superheroes, and they have this guy in a costume in the middle of them. You know, I read your review. We're arguing this is a science fiction film. But again, it's one take. It's not the...
I feel very isolated.
The definitive version.
It's a little bit like Shock Value. I'm talking about summer movies here, where you keep pushing the boundaries and keep pushing the boundaries and keep pushing the boundaries until... your shock isn't shocking anymore. Marilyn Manson, Madonna, whatever. I feel like summer movies are reaching this point where there's just these endless set pieces that you've seen again and again. Yeah. And I want to know where summer movies are going that is going to be more interesting than this.
Right. I get that. Well, I presume that many of you out there have also seen Man of Steel, and you should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or at the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what you thought of Man of Steel. So our other topic today, we are calling Getting Better with Age, and we're not talking about ourselves or Henry Cavill or anyone else. And this was an idea that we got from our Facebook page. And so we're going to talk about things that we liked more, you know, as they aged, as we aged, perhaps some combination of the two, since everything ages at the same rate, right? Time being what it is. Theory of relativity. Stephen Thompson, getting better with age.
Huh? Ah, nice. Aye. Nice little blurb there. I appreciate it. You know, I've talked about a couple of things that I've felt this way about in the past. I've talked about Tom Waits.
You're the head, you're on the spear. You're the nail on the cross. You're the fly in my beer. You're the key that got lost. You're the letter from Jesus on the bathroom wall. Your mother's superior with only a bra. You're the same, you're the same, you're the same kind of man as me.
Tom Waits' music is better the older and the older you are, and the more life has pummeled you and kicked you into the gutter.
Sure.
The more you can relate to these gutter scoundrels in his songs. And I think that Tom Waits' music is a perfect example of something that, not only as he has aged and his music has continued to be superb, but as the listener ages, it seems less cartoonish and more just visceral and powerful. But I think I've talked about Tom Waits before. I've certainly talked about how when Futurama first came out, I didn't particularly care for it, and then when I watched it,
we've done
kids,
a couple of topics.
I've talked about a couple of these things. I want to talk about late 80s funk music, specifically two songs. One is Word Up by the band Cameo, which I thought was just silly and just weird sounding when I was a kid, and which over time now feels like an absolute outright masterpiece. And another example, which I have to summon from memory, a tweet by our pal Dave Holmes, who said something along the lines of, every time I hear on NPR them referencing the EU, I immediately get the song Da Butt going through my head. And I tweeted him back like, you too! Every time, and they mentioned the EU on Morning Edition today, and I immediately, the entire drive in, I have going through my head, and I wanted to acknowledge Dave, the fact that
he thinks like you,
he highlighted a universal truth, and B, the fact that EU, which stands for Experience Unlimited, which I remember when EU first came out, my uncle saying, it's a good thing they're not called Potential Unlimited. the song Da Butt by EU and Word Up by Cameo, which even though they are absolutely of their time, they are mid to late 80s funk music, I did not appreciate them in their time the way that I love them desperately today.
Yeah, and I would say it's a little different, but some of you know that two Thursdays ago I held a Twitter-wide Groove is in the Heart listen along where everyone synced up and listened to Groove is in the Heart at the same time.
I play that in my boxing class.
And this was the fault originally of Julie Whitaker, our friend Julie Whitaker, who suggested Groove is in the Heart for one of my crowdsourced happy making playlists. Yeah. And so I put it on there, and I've discovered, and you will be able to relate to this, Stephen, I discovered that Groove is in the Heart has a 100% approval rating, like Captain Sully, as we've discussed in the past.
Captain Sully
and Groove is in the Heart, and everyone loves Groove is in the Heart. Similar feel to me, like at the time I thought it was silly, but now, oh my gosh, there's nothing better in
it
the
world. It has aged wonderfully well in a way that a lot of songs from that era haven't. A couple other examples, more or less kind of from that era, that I think are still wonderful, Walking on Sunshine by Katrina and the Waves.
Nice.
I know there
We part ways there.
I know there are people who detest this song.
Hello.
I love that song.
I used to think maybe you love me. Now, baby, I'm sure.
Chris Klimek. Can you follow that?
Oh, man, that is tough. All right, so I'm going to stay in the realm of comic books. Mm-hmm. Two older than Katrina and the Waves. Long-defunct comic book publisher called First Comics. Mm-hmm. Nexus was a sort of whimsical, far-future sci-fi comic, totally absent the sort of grimness that you all deplored in the Superman movie. Just wonderfully imaginative and funny. That comic was gone for a long time. It is back in print now from Dark Horse Comics. And another comic that was from that same publisher was called American Flag. That's two G's and an exclamation point. American Flag was, as you do. Yeah, this was, far future seen from the vantage point of about 1983 or 84. So I didn't get to these as these were first published either. But this is a satire set after the collapse in the U.S. when the government has relocated to Mars. And our hero is a former porn star named Ruben Flagg, who, since he has been replaced by a video simulacrum, I guess, a digital being sampled from his prior performances, he needed to get a job, and he is now a Plexus Ranger, one of the last lawmen trying to keep order in Chicago.
Awesome.
Sounds like a porn star.
It is one of those things that I didn't quite get it when I read it when I was about 12, and in retrospect, it's one of those things like RoboCop from about the same era, where the satire of that movie comes through when you see it as an adult, and it seems frighteningly prescient, but also really funny. So those two comics, Nexus and American Flag, I liked them when I was 12, but I like them a whole lot more now.
Who's the artist on Nexus?
Steve Rude.
Okay, Steve Rude. There is a unabashed sexuality to Steve Rude's art, which I think probably hit me squarely.
and it hit
when I was looking at it again, it hit me again.
I gave you a volume of Nexus a couple of Christmases ago.
That's certainly true.
Well, maybe I will have to read it. Glenn Weldon, getting better with age.
My first instincts were also stuff we've talked about in the show, so I'm not going to hit those. But, I mean, news radio. You keep going back to that thing. That thing gets better. The writing just is timeless, and it's funny, and it's fitting its sitcom sort of genre. It's hitting all the sitcom tropes, but doing it really well. The Monkees, the show The Monkees. Petra talked about it when
she did. Our friend Petra.
It's just so good, and it just keeps getting better. And the fact that it is so of its time is sort of adds to it and adds a charm to it that doesn't change it. But for me to talk about this one specific album, I have to give a little bit of background about what it was like to grow up in Philadelphia, just outside Philadelphia, I should say, in the western suburbs of Philadelphia in the early 80s, when there were only two classic rock stations that if you were a boy, you were allowed to listen to, and they were identical. They were the same freaking station. They were WMMR and WYSP.
I know them well.
And here's what...
93.3 and 94.1.
These were both dinosaur rock, classic rock, adult album-oriented rock, and here's what they played. Zeppelin. That's pretty much it. Just that. Just Zeppelin. It was like traffic on the 8s. You could not get away from Led Zeppelin. They also threw in some Van Halen and some Who, Rolling Stones. Maybe you'd get some Pink Floyd, but boys were not allowed to listen to Pink Floyd. That was kind of weird. It was kind of outside.
Well, it is Pink.
It is.
Right. And Floyd.
And weird and outside.
Women, girls were allowed to listen to Top 40. Dudes were not. Michael Jackson, that was outside.
I was allowed to listen to WSTW.
You
weren't.
See, I was not.
Yeah.
You know, God forbid the B-52s. God forbid Blondie. David Bowie was considered a little...
Sure.
Yet Queen, ironically, no. Because here's what 14-year-old boys don't have.
They will rock
subtext.
You.
Yeah. It's true. They have text.
They don't get it.
It's true.
We were supposed to take Kiss seriously. You know who's not taking Kiss seriously?
Kiss.
For example. So, amid all of this classic rock, dinosaur rock, you hear the song Salisbury Hill by Peter Gabriel. I've talked about it in the show before. It got promptly overplayed.
And used in
montage after montage. You can't hear that song without sort of not having any kind of emotion reaction muted because it's been heard so much.
Right.
But it made me buy the album, Peter Gabriel's self-titled, the first of four self-titled albums. There's a theme here called Peter Gabriel. And the first song on this album is called Moribund the Burgermeister. Cut the chaos in the market square. I don't know what, I don't know why. But suddenly drawn down there, their bodies twisting and turning in a thousand ways. The eyes are rolling round and round into a distant gaze. I look at that crowd, some are turning up in the air, drowning in a tunnel of blood. It's called Moribund the Burgermeister because words are fun things to say. Mm-hmm. Pretty much that's it. If you go through the lyrics, you can't really tell what's going on. It's just that words are fun things to say. And there was this unabashed prog rock, self-indulgent pomposity, bombast, texture upon texture upon texture. Mm-hmm. I ate it up with a big old spoon. I remember I had to like buy a Bengals album, and it was like I was buying porn. I had to hide it, you know? I had to buy Def Leppard's Pyromania on top of it.
Uh-huh. I was the same way with late period Chicago.
Right, right. Yeah. Oh, God. Well,
yeah.
Well, that's I was
going to
forgive you.
At least they put numbers after their albums.
Don't get him started.
Come on, Peter Gabriel.
But Peter Gabriel, he got a pass because Salisbury Hill rocked. So I could...
Did it.
Yeah, well, to a 14-year-old boy.
In sort of a gentle, quirky, breaking out of an asylum to go...
Uh-huh. Yeah, I gotcha. I gotcha.
Hitting the wish fulfillment thing. So this album, the very first one, I put it away for 20 years. I just couldn't listen to it because I had overplayed it so much. But I took it out recently, and it's still just as bombastic and overblown. But it starts with Moribund the Burgermeister. It ends with Here Comes the Flood, which is the biggest, most self-indulgent. Just, oh, God, it's like it's not subtle. But, man, it hits me. I just love it.
Excellent, excellent. Well, this took me in the direction of thinking, what did I appreciate more as I got older? And I kept going in the direction of the things they made me read in high school. Mm. Because, and this is probably partly because Lynn Neary had a lovely piece, a lovely radio piece within the last couple weeks, which was about the kind of books that are assigned to kids and the kinds of books that kids read for pleasure. And it was sort of lamenting the fact that they don't assign classic books to kids as much as they used to in school. And I get that, and I get the concern, and I get the concern that they're reading things that are at a simpler, quote-unquote, reading level. But when I think about things like the fact that they had us read Animal Farm in eighth grade, I get having high school kids read Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. I get that. But I think that there can be a way that some of these things, if you get them at the wrong time, they feel like work.
Yeah.
And it gets into your head that it's work. And you don't understand that Shakespeare is making, for one thing, there are times when people are afraid to teach kids that Shakespeare is making dirty jokes. Mm-hmm. And so there's an entire level of humor that sort of isn't talked about with kids because you don't really want to talk about the dirty joke. And so it comes off like it's just a lot of words of nothing and seriousness. Mm-hmm. And for me, some of the stuff that I read in high school, especially Shakespeare, until I experienced it as an adult, it really did not have a lot of meaning to me. And I still believe that one of the reasons I did not wind up as a big fiction reader is that in high school, I really felt like fiction reading turned into like math. Mm-hmm. And I just wasn't a person who took to fiction reading for pleasure. And I wonder whether if I hadn't been reading things that I, for whatever reason, perhaps limited to myself, if I hadn't been reading things that I wasn't really able to get the most out of, that might have happened somewhat less. Some of you know that for the blog a year or two ago, I read Moby Dick. And I don't think I was ever assigned Moby Dick, but I remember thinking as I was reading it, assigning this book to a 10th grader would be a great way to make them hate reading.
Right.
Because there are things about Moby Dick involving kind of how it's structured and why it's done that way that occurred to me that I felt like there's no way this would have occurred to me when I was in high school. In high school, this would have been a wall of dumb stuff about whales. Like, that's what it would have felt like to me in high school. And I wasn't a dumb person, but I would not have been able to appreciate it. So I think I would single out a lot of the reading I did in high school as something that I've been much more able to appreciate when I was older. And I've kind of had to rehabilitate my own interest in reading fiction. Mm-hmm. Because I did come to think of it as an obligation, as something that you did like work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I taught comp lit for a while to freshmen in college, and many of them had to be retrained that writers could write in a voice that they recognize. Mm-hmm. Because they had read so much Theodore Dreiser. They had read so much James Fenimore Cooper in high school that it never occurred to them that writing could be a thing that they might do one day.
Right.
Which is why giving a kid a story like A&P by John Updike, which we've talked about on the show before, is a revelation because it's written in their voice. It still holds up, and it's a big turning point. I think it's important to have kids reach and try to, you know, have their reach exceed their grasp. I think it's fine.
Well, and to be able to translate the different dialects of different eras of writing and to
absolutely
understand. And I think that's a great point, though.
And I should point out, we had an excellent, and I had great English teachers in high school. I had great English teachers who encouraged me to write, who made us write a lot, which is the most important thing that happened in my entire life, probably, is how much they made me write in high school, because that's just how my school was. And by the time I was a senior, I took a class with Mr. Brown. Hi, Mr. Brown. And it was a class in contemporary literature for one trimester. We were on a trimester system. I had one trimester of contemporary literature. We read a couple of things that started to make me think about this as a little bit more of a living thing. We read Blood of the Lamb.
Oh, sure.
Peter DeVries, which is a really interesting kind of, when you've been reading a lot of really, really heavy kind of high school reading, a book like that is sort of like, and I remember really liking it. And I was getting into a bunch of it. But anyway, that's sort of where this took me, was in the direction of literature and reading.
I'm glad that Linda's choice was like Canterbury Tales and mine was De Butt by E.
That's because that this is us. This is us running the entire gamut. Yeah. This is us.
Alpha Omega De Butt.
I'm going to tell you about a real email that I just got from my mom about 2 weeks ago. It just said, oh, Chris, I found your old copy of Moby Dick and I've read it now. So should we keep it or can we give it away? So I thought that was really burying the lead, that my mom just found Moby Dick and read it.
Yeah, actually, my former boss gave me a hardback copy of Moby Dick when I was reading it, and kind of encouraging me and gifting me this copy of Moby Dick, which I appreciated an awful lot, and I have kept it. And even though I don't know if I'll ever read it again, it was a very nice gesture.
It might be a winner.
Moby Dick is one of those things. All right, and that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
First of all, I must fall on a proverbial sword.
Yes.
I made a stupid mistake on last week's show.
That I agreed with unthinkingly.
Well, I said it unthinkingly, so we're even. I said that Nothing Better by the Postal Service was a duet between Ben Gibbard and Jenny Lewis from Rilo Kiley. I was like, oh, Jenny Lewis from Rilo Kiley. It's Jen Wood. It is not Jenny Lewis from Rilo Kiley. I saw the Postal Service live, and it was Jenny Lewis from Rilo Kiley.
Right.
But on the album, it is Jen Wood. Apologies to all who noticed, and even double apologies to those who didn't. I've been getting wonderful responses to my call out for recipes as I plan to attempt to learn how to cook this summer while my kids are away. I have gotten some marvelous suggestions. Also, I do feel the need to remind, if people are still thinking about sending them in, A, send them to popculturehappyhour@gmail.com, and B, remember that I am poor and sort of immediately terrified by long lists of things which need to be diced.
Yeah.
Finally, this is certainly an old standby of mine. It will surprise no one that it is something that made me happy. But I spent the last 3 hours of Father's Day, which, as I may have indicated, was a day spent without my children. But I did spend the last 3 hours of Father's Day watching Glenn Hansard perform a concert at the 930 Club. And he prefaced his set by explaining that he had lost his voice earlier in the day and he was going to do his best to power through. And as I said, he spent the last 3 hours performing and was wonderful, as he so often is.
I bet that was great.
Sorry I didn't take you to the Glenn Hansard concert.
Chris Klimek, what's making you happy this week?
All right, two very quickly. New Nico Case single.
Oh, it's so good.
I'm a man. That's what you raised me to be. I'm not an identity crisis. This was planned. I'm a man. It's called Man. This is a little teaser from her forthcoming album, Peter Gabriel. No, apparently the full title of the album is The Worse Things Get, The Harder I Fight, The Harder I Fight, The More I Love You. It finds her in like a more sort of direct, aggressive mode than anything on her prior album did, which is 4 years ago now, so it's really exciting to hear Nico Case again. Also, one of the things, the delights of experiencing a piece of culture, particularly one that's challenging or sort of outside of your established area, with someone you respect, is the benefit of getting that additional perspective right away when you're still sorting through it, which is why when you, Linda, invited me to go see Fast and Furious 6 a couple weeks ago, I was so flattered to be asked. So this movie's been out for a few weeks now. Are you aware of the Vulture post and the follow-up post on the British film site Empire attempting to calculate the length of the runway that on which the final 13-minute action sequence of this film is set, wherein a bunch of vehicles driven by an impressively ethnic diverse but equally forgettable cast of characters are chasing an Autonav AN-225, apparently the world's largest cargo plane, according to Wikipedia, attempting to bring it down with hooks and yelling and donuts.
Hooks and yelling.
It's kind of true.
Whatever Vin Diesel does. So the cool thing about this is that at least two of these apparently independent attempts to calculate the length of the runway came in within a mile of each other. Vultures got it at 28.83 miles. Empire has it at 27.86 miles, which leads me to believe that there must be some credibility here. Well, I should say here, now, they both did provide the context that the world's largest paved runway is something like 3.5 miles long.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Largest unpaved, about 7 miles. So we're way over, which leads me to question everything franchise, actually. But there was one enterprising commenter who said, no, it was really a Rashomon-type thing. Like, all of the different people in the different vehicles, we're seeing what they're doing simultaneously, which is kind of a brilliant... Glenn, if I said that explanation was worthy of a Marvel Comics no prize,
absolutely.
Do you think...
Yes, definitely.
All right. I'm sure a lot of pop culture Happy Hour listeners know what that is.
Wonderful. Thank you,
making me
Chris.
Happy.
Thank you, Chris. I will take you to another movie very soon. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
We're in a glut of End of Days movies right now.
Sure are.
There's two End of Days comedies that I know about right now. One is This is the End. The other is the terribly titled Rapture Palooza. Now, Rapture Palooza is available streaming, download, but also I think in theaters at the same time. Of these two films, the Rapture Palooza is the less ingratiating. It's not trying as hard to give you giant belly laughs and giant scares, mm-hmm. because, I mean, there are actually some shocks in This is the End. It has a chillier, cooler emotional temperature. I think it's funnier. These are the people you'll see in it. Paul Scheer, Rob Hubel, Tyler Labine, Thomas Lennon, Craig Robinson, Rob Corddry, starring Anna Kendrick. The humor in this film is located in the reaction shots and the sort of under-the-breath dialogue of people having conversations. There's also, the world's ending. But the thing that's funny, and it's not laugh-out-loud funny, I want to stress that, mm-hmm. but I could watch Anna Kendrick react to a horribly filthy thing that Craig Robinson, as the Antichrist, is saying to her for an afternoon. She is just so good in the moment of looking mortified.
She's very funny.
And trying not to show that she's looking mortified. I really, really enjoyed that. Again, not belly laughs, but really kind of smart and incredibly enjoyable, terribly titled Rapture Palooza.
Excellent. What is making me happy this week starts with something that has not been making me especially happy, which is that it has been a very rough few weeks for a phenomenon I have now started to refer to as talking while female on the internet. As a lot of people know, there was some writing that Lindy West, who's a marvelous, marvelous writer at Jezebel and a bunch of other places, Lindy had been talking about a variety of things, including rape jokes, and has never taken the position that you should never be allowed to make a rape joke, but had sort of encouraged people to think about your rape jokes, think about whose expense they are made at, think about why you need them or why you're using them, so forth. This is a debate that goes back quite a long way. But for some reason, she went on the show Totally Biased with Kamau Bell. And she sat down with another comic and they sort of hashed this out. And it was a very respectful conversation. But what followed was a lot of really ugly business directed at her. And it really kind of had gotten me down. And I certainly have never put myself in a position to take that kind of what she did. But I was thinking about this a lot. And there's a lot of this was kind of weighing very heavily on me. And then on Friday, Patton Oswalt posted an essay. He has been in the past really a defender of sort of people in comedy clubs can say whatever they want and you need to shut up and don't be an obnoxious jerk who tries to interfere with comics. And it's always a reaction that has really disappointed me because I respect him so much and I admire him so much. And I've always felt it was a reaction without nuance and a very disappointing one. He posted an essay in which he starts off talking about something else that's been going on with him, which is dealing with a guy who steals jokes. Mm-hmm. And so it goes on. He talks about thieving of jokes. And then he talks about hecklers, which is another thing where he's always had a very sort of strong position that all hecklers are equally deplorable no matter what the reason for the heckling is, et cetera, et cetera. And then all of a sudden writes this piece at the end where he talks about sort of and so and winds up and starts to sort of say, here's how I came to reconsider my position about rape jokes. And here's how I came to examine my own thinking and feel like I had probably been wrong and feel like I had probably not understood the difference between what somebody was saying and what they were not saying. Here's where I wasn't listening. I still believe, you know, maybe 80% of what I've always said about this, X, Y, Z, all these things. But came around at the end and sort of talked about having learned something from all this noise that was going on that was so upsetting and frustrating. And for me, as somebody who writes a lot about gender issues on the internet, it's incredibly important to occasionally have someone really smart say, I got something out of all of this. I got something out of the fact that people have subjected themselves to these really ugly experiences. And in this case, the fact that Lindy really had subjected herself to this very unpleasant experience. He came out of it saying, I took something away from that. That had value to me. I learned something. I feel differently now. And it really made me feel, you know, as they would say in Singing in the Rain, you know, ain't been in vain for nothing. You know, it's just, and it's very, very, very important to me that people occasionally express those feelings and express when they've learned something and express when they've taken something away from it, because it is often extracted at a very high cost from people, not from me, but from a lot of writers. And so what made me happy was kind of the renewal of my faith that there is a reason to have difficult conversations in public. And so I really give him huge props for that. I'm sorry that's so long, but it is a kind of a big thing in my life and a bunch of other people's. So that is what is making me happy this week. Discourse. I enjoy it.
Nuance,
discourse.
Words, not merely fun things to say.
That's right. That's right.
They also convey messages.
And that is our show. And you can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. Chris, I'm betting we can follow you on Twitter. I do follow you.
KLIMEK, like the crack. There is no cracker.
CTKLIMEK. C.T. Klimek. You can follow our absent pal, Trey Graham, at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are listening to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here, as always.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.